What's going on, my friends? This is Alex Pardo, and you're now listening to episode 338 on The Flip Empire Show.
Welcome to The Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
What's up? What's up? Welcome back. If it's your first time joining us, thank you for joining me here on the Flip Empire Show, where every Monday I deliver masterclass expert interviews. And today I'm excited because I have a really good friend of mine, Mike Moulton, out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Mike is somebody, as you're going to hear now in a few minutes, who we've just come to become good friends. And I met a couple years ago at a high level mastermind we're both a part of. And Mike and I just, it's interesting because we didn't even know this until recently, but we have so much in common. Mike comes from General Electric. He was part of their information leadership program, ILP. I was part of GE's financial management program, FMP. And Mike traveled around the world as a global IT manager, certified Six Sigma Black Belt. So he comes with a lot of corporate knowledge and experience, which has served him really well in his brokerage and his investing business. Similar to me, 2005, him and I both fired our GE managers and bosses. And he went on to launch a real estate investing firm and brokerage. And basically his company out of Charlotte focuses on deals that provide passive income and high margins. He's a fix and flip guy, but he also manages several assets. And what I love about Mike is that he's really sharp, and he's got a very lean, mean operation. It's a team of five, including himself, and that's by design, and that's on purpose. So today we're going to talk about working with iBuyers. And if you don't know what an iBuyer is, you definitely want to tune in. Even if you do know what an iBuyer is, are you working with them, and are you profiting from selling properties to iBuyers? So Mike is going to get into the details and provide some case studies on exactly how he's done that. So I'm excited to jump right into this interview with my man, Mike Moulton. Mike, what's going on, my friend? How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. How you doing, Alex?
Dude, it's always always a pleasure connecting with you, my man. You and I met a couple of years ago. I think this December it's going to make a couple of years, and you're always one of those guys, man, that I'm drawn to, and I'm grateful we've built up a friendship the last year and a half or so. So for everybody listening in, Mike and I actually met through a mastermind that we're both a part of. We actually joined at the same time. And, you know, we've struck up a friendship, and Mike's doing big things out in the Charlotte, North Carolina market. And we have been talking about getting him on the podcast here because he's doing some really cool, unique things with iBuyers. And that's actually what we're going to be focusing the content of today's podcast episode on. So, dude, like I said, man, pleasure connecting with you, and thanks for taking the time, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Alex. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm super pumped about it.
Yep. And then hopefully, man, in the future, we could tell people about your podcast, which I know you've been kind of thinking about doing. So I have no doubt people would get a tremendous amount of value and content from your show whenever, if you decide to launch it. So anyway, man, why don't you, for people that don't know you, Mike, talk before you got into real estate. What was your background? You and I share some similarities as far as like where we come from, the corporate world. So talk about what you were doing prior to real estate and ultimately how you ended up getting into this game.
Sure, absolutely. So I, back in the day, I'm not going to date myself because, you know, I'm a little bit older than you, Alex, but I was definitely in the population of corporate boob and rat race, which I can't say was, for me, definitely wasn't the way to go. It was, you know, I learned a lot back then, got a lot of process background, worked for GE, General Electric, was managing projects in their IT division, then became a manager quickly and was living all around the globe. So that was all in my 20s, and it was super cool at the time. And I did a lot with Six Sigma and just repeatable processes and procedures and quality and stuff like that. So then I went back in 2005, I quit, fired my manager, just decided I couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't go into my office there and listen to these people like require my time to get into a million meetings where we may or may not ever see the outcome. And 7 months has gone off the clock of my life. And then they changed the initiative. So yeah. I said, all right, I'm done. So I went back, and believe it or not, man, you'll crack up. But I got into this thing through listening to, I went to a Russ Whitney, one of those infomercials, man. I went to one of their like weekend courses. I bought four of their products, like on wholesaling, renovating, like being a landlord, whatever, all these boot camps. And I went to the first one, which was wholesaling, and it was in North Carolina. And the first thing the lady said was, she started talking about these RIAs and how you can get more info there. So I'm like, wow, what's a RIA? So anyway, I joined my local RIA. And it's funny because one of our other buddies, Larry Goins, was the president of our local RIA that I went to.
Yeah.
So I went there and realized, wow, you know, because I spent $5,000 a class on Russ's stuff. And then I went to one class, and then, and long story short, it was funny. So his classes all came with deeds, or I believe. So I went back and sold the other three classes on eBay to some guy in New Jersey, and then just went to my local RIA.
Oh, man.
And that's where the magic was born. So anyway, yeah, so I got in through all that, and then started at all basically marketing for pretty homes, selling them, taking them over subject to, selling them on lease options. And then in North Carolina, they started saying, hey, you know, subject to could be illegal. And all the local investors were freaking out, and they didn't read the little fine print that they could be illegal if you weren't licensed. So the state wanted to be able to put their finger on you. So I just went and got my sales. At the time, there was an agent license and a broker license, and then you could find your own brokerage all within like 10 weeks. So I got in on the last group of people that could do that. Wow. And just opened up a brokerage. Yeah.
Wow. So, very cool, man. And so, man, a couple things. So you and I obviously came from General Electric. I was in their financial management program, and I also quit in 2005. I didn't know that was the same year that you decided to fire GE. So we got that in common as well. And it sounds like initially you got started, like a lot of people get started wholesaling, right? Because the barriers to entry are so low. With you, it sounds like you got started more on the creative side with, you know, taking over mortgages subject to and lease options. Was that your first couple deals was more on the creative side?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That I actually did not start as a wholesaler. I still had direct to seller marketing going, but it was more to get rentals, like pretty rentals that didn't need that much work. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, taking over mortgages and whatnot was a lot faster way when you're first starting to be able to build a portfolio. So that's what I did right up until the market crashed.
Got it. I was going to say, man, let me take a step or two back. Were you married? Did you have kids when you decided to leave GE and get into real estate?
Yes, that's a great question. So I was similar to your FMP program. I was in this IMLP program for information management at GE. And that's where I met my wife, Jean. And I bought my first property in 1998 when I graduated college. And then I started just basically 2002, I started getting into some more buy and hold, but Gene was helping me, at the time, nights and weekends. We didn't have kids. We were buying like bank REOs and renovating them. So on nights and weekends. So we're always hard workers, man. Like it's just kind of what we do, but, at the time to make that break. So it was fortunate enough, Jean does really well in corporate America, and she still does. She stayed in it, and she's an executive over here locally at a big bank, but, that's still not her passion either. But it's funny. We get into this with my parents all the time when we're having a couple bourbons, is that my dad's like, you know, it's funny that, that you had Jean, so you were able to go do all this stuff. And I'm like, well, listen, yes, there's food going to be on the table and, you know, gas in the car or whatever if something goes bad, but Gene's not going to cover all this real estate if it goes south, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
But there's stability there with health insurance and stuff like that. So, so we decided, as a couple, I was just going to fire my manager, at the time in 2005, they were promoting me, and they were rehashing it all. And I think they were going to try to send me to like some other part of the U.S. and one of us was going to have to take the back seat to the other's career. So we just said, screw it. I'm going full time and went for it.
Yeah. So you were in a fortunate position where Jean, it sounds like she was supportive and, you know, she had your back as far as, you know, you, you know, making the shift and transition from GE to starting your own thing.
Yeah. She was very supportive as a wife. And then, you know, it's even with 5 or 10 rentals though, like if like 40% of your portfolio doesn't pay for 2 months, you know, like Jean can't cover that. So that's why I kind of like, no, she's been extremely supportive and come in helpful in a lot of situations, but like for people that are looking to make the break, like make it based on your business, you know, your business plan and what you can do. Not, I would set mini goals, like, you know, like 90 day, 6 month goals, save up enough of whatever your reserves are. I know you and I both talked about this just with the Life and Air program, mm-hmm. like knowing what your monthly nut is, so to speak, like for your family.
Yeah.
Starting there and then just figuring out a plan to cover it. So if you're going to wholesaling, maybe it's like 2 wholesale deals, we'll cover that. And, you know, what's your fallback plan? And here's the other thing for a lot of people too, Alex, is, you know, nothing has to be forever, right? So if you've got a spouse that, or, you know, that's going to quit their job and come work with you, or you're going to quit and go full time, you know, in 6 months, you could always like, you know, you could always go back into the workforce if you felt you needed to and it didn't work out, you know?
Man, that is such a good point. I'm glad you shared that, Mike, because I know for a fact there's going to be quite a few people listening that are stuck in a job that they don't like. It doesn't fill them up. They're not happy. They have that, you know, that crappy feeling in their stomach on Sunday evening that they have to go to work the next day. But it's hard because they have a family, they're married, they got to put food on the table. And some people just get caught up in that. And then they wake up 5, 10, 15 years later and they're still in the same position or worse. So I appreciate your perspective on that. And you really bring clarity to the situation that like nothing is forever. You know, like if you make that break and it just doesn't work out for A or B reason, like nothing's preventing you from going back into the workforce, right? Having said that, I would kind of caution you. I think if you are going to make that break, you kind of have to burn the ships in my mind and, you know, tell yourself that like failure isn't an option. Like you're going to fail and there's going to be less to learn. But the fact that like the only way you fail is if you quit and you just, you know what I mean? So hopefully we weren't planning on going in this direction with the show, but hopefully that opens up some people's eyes that are just not happy with their job. Cause I know I wasn't when I was working at GE and it sounds like you weren't either. And we were in a position where we were able to make that shift and you know, now run a business that we enjoy and supports our lifestyle. So with that said, man, what does the team look like today? I know you have a pretty lean machine over there in Charlotte.
Yeah, that's what I like to keep it lean. The challenges with keeping it lean are that, you know, obviously if something happens to one person or one person isn't performing, you're probably stepping back into that role or getting some overlap with another team member. But I've got 5 of us and a VA. So, and we've been this way forever and we're just like my model, just so everyone knows, is primarily fix and flip. We are holding more houses now too. So we're adding more units to the rental portfolio. I've got my first mixed use commercial warehouse project under contract last week. So awesome. I'm super pumped about that. That's going to be an amazing one. So we're adding more stuff in, and also I own a brokerage. So that brokerage I founded when I started, I still keep it going and we sell all our stuff through there. So, my team, so being set up for a fix and flip model, you know, I've got a construction manager, let's start at the top, acquisitions manager. Then I've got a construction manager that, gets everything renovated. I've got a dispositions or licensed agent that gets everything sold. And I've got an office manager and she also helps with, lead feeder role and closing coordination. Okay. And then we call her the queen bee because our brokerage is Bee Home Solutions, but she literally is like a Jack Triss of all trades. And then, there's me holding it all together, raising money, et cetera. So that's basically it, man. I stay lean, keep the overhead low, and just, you know, try to, we stay profitable instead of being overhead.
I want to dive into that a little bit, Mike, because I have some personal experience with this as well. And I know you and I have had some conversations whenever we've hung out. There's a lot of people out there that, you know, they see other investors on Facebook or in any other places talking about growing and scaling. And they see these massive operations and they see all these deals that they're closing on a monthly basis. And they just say, and they assume, they're like, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And I want to go do that. Talk to me about your mindset as far as keeping it lean, keeping overhead as low as possible while still maintaining a healthy profitability versus growing and scaling, and what some of the challenges with that are. Because, you know, man, we're a part of a very high level mastermind where there's so many guys in there that have big teams. And with that comes a lot of overhead and complexity. And it's not always, you know, sunshine and rainbows, right? So talk to me about like the difference between remaining somewhat small and profitable versus growing, and why you chose to kind of go this route.
Yeah. The reason, you know, I chose to go this route is I think a lot of it too was the corporate background, like just seeing all the inconsistencies and just people that are not being used, like in certain organizations. Like I just didn't want to do that. So like, I tell everybody, I run my business. My business is a wheel, like on a bicycle. So there's five spokes. And if one of the spokes breaks, the tire goes flat and we all feel it. So, you know, the real thing is accountability, and everything comes down to, you know, it really comes down to net, what you're making, you know, what you're keeping, not what you're grossing, right? Because
absolutely,
we all have those friends that are just, you get caught up in the, hey, here's the latest marketing thing and let's all throw 20 grand at it this month. And then, you know, if you didn't get 21 grand back, then you're like, crap, what do I do on month two? And that gets super stressful. So, you know, we keep it lean and just scale. Like right now I'm scaling more into other, like let's scale into other pieces of real estate that we're trying to do. But let's, like, the number of deals is, it's an indicator of how well you're doing, but it's not like really your net. It's a business. It's not number of deals. So like, you know what I mean? So like, you really got to set your profit goals, and then it might say, how many deals do we need to do to hit those profit goals? But here's a perfect example. I've got a friend here in Charlotte that is an awesome custom home builder. And it's just, I've told you this, but it's just him and his son. And they get 100 to 250K profit out of every home they build. And they're really good at it. And they don't have any podio. They don't have an assistant. They don't have any of that. And they're putting on rubber boots and standing on their parcels of land, like about 5 hours a day. Mike's still managing everybody. But like, they're, you know, they make 800, 1.3 million, like for very, very small volume, like 8 or 9 deals. Whereas then you've got the guys with 20 people and they're bringing home like 170 a year. Right. And what, like, there's nothing wrong with making 170K a year. But my point is, as long as you're going brain dead, you're not going brain dead managing that kind of operation. So
That's right.
I think it's important now, you know, for people to know what you want, right? Like, I don't know if some people get like puffing their chest thinking it's awesome to say I did like 700 deals this year and, you know, I'm divorced and fat and ugly and whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's trade-offs, I guess.
We're on the same page, man. I've been beating that drum on this podcast for a while now of getting clear on your vision, what you want versus like trying to live somebody else's vision or trying to go do something else just because you see it on Facebook or whatever the case might be. Like, bigger and more isn't always better. A good mutual friend of ours, Mike, Christina Krause, you know, told me and shared with our group a while back. She's like, scale to be better, don't scale to be bigger. And I think that's even that much more accurate in this kind of market that we're in now. So cool, man. I'm glad we touched on that. Let's dive into iBuyers. So first and foremost, I don't want to assume that everybody listening to this knows what an iBuyer is. So why don't we just kind of start with the basics? What's the definition of an iBuyer, like in your words?
Yeah, I actually, you know, it's funny. Forbes magazine defined them, because I looked at this when I gave a pitch at our mastermind group, exactly what people call it, but it's basically a company that'll make you an offer on your house within minutes or days versus like putting it on the market and listing it. And they'll do it sight unseen, and they have a model, a certain valuation model that they know how to price your home at. And the biggest thing that's the indicator that's really interesting, like with all this talking to homeowners directly, is that the way they do it. So they keep I know in every, you pick any market that they're in the US, and you'll be like, wow, they bought that home for 200 and then they sold it for 204. And you're like, they're losing their shirts. And
yeah, how do they
and
make
in
money?
Some cases they are. Yeah. Yeah, and in some cases they are. I think you've seen like Zillow got into this now, and what has happened over the past week with their valuation, and they're losing money out of their butt. But here's how they're doing it though. So like most of us investors, we go in and we talk to a homeowner and we say, hey, listen, you know, your house is worth 200 fixed up ARV or whatever. And then we take off repairs, and then we've got 10% for marketing. And if you're going to sell with a realtor and all that, and we walk them down to that net number. Well, what these guys are doing, they're flipping the script and they're going in and saying, hey, my, you know, your estimate's 200. How about we give you 200? And then they're like, oh man, that's awesome. I'm going to get 200. And then they go in off the record and on the CD or the closing disclosure or HUD or whatever you want to call it, they're putting in these atrocious fees, and then they hit you with repairs later. So you're netting that number that all of us small mom and pops went in and gave them anyway. Like they could be there, they could be a little bit higher. It really depends. So that's basically the definition of an iBuyer. So for anyone listening, you really should take a look at, this is learning number one of this call or this podcast, is you really should look at how they're making offers and how they're marketing. And maybe you could learn a thing or two and start looking like them when you're, instead of competing with them, look like them when you're presenting offers.
Got it. And so, you know, for people to start researching these iBuyers, we're talking about, you mentioned Zillow, OfferPad is another one. What are some of the other like major iBuyers that you've been either researching and or working with?
Yeah. So there's OfferPad, Opendoor, Zillow Instant Offers. We've got in the Southeast here, this guy named Mark Spain out of Atlanta. He's kind of, he will make you an offer. His are more really low offers. He'd rather list your home. There's a couple other options, that aren't necessarily iBuyers, but they have similar programs like Ribbon and Knock. They've got like Trade Your Home In type programs. Uh-huh. And there's a couple more that have even popped up. Like Phoenix is like the test market for everything. So they have a couple more up there. I have only worked with those ones that I've listed though. So, I found that, yeah, just out in, to summarize it in our market, and I think most of the Southeast, OfferPad is the easiest to work with and the easiest to kind of get an exit strategy at, like a hybrid model as an investor.
Right. So what was it about these iBuyers that, you know, that I guess presented an opportunity in your eyes? Like what's the benefit of, you know, us as wholesalers, as fix and flip investors or buy and hold investors, you know, people listening to this podcast, what are the benefits of working with iBuyers?
So the benefits of working with iBuyers are they don't always, so like take Opendoor, they're or OfferPad, they're a great company in my opinion. I mean, they got their stuff together. They're doing 800 deals a month. They're out of Phoenix. But when they're in Phoenix and they're making an offer on my stuff here in Charlotte, they don't know this market as good as I do. They might think they do, but their acquisitions teams in Phoenix, and this could probably be with any company, right? So they'll look at all their different evaluations and whatnot, but they might not see that there's like a train track next to that house that I know everything on the other side of that house doesn't do well, right? Or no one, like, because our retail side of our business takes buyers around in that neighborhood and says they all don't want to look at the house on the other side of that train track. And I'm being like facetious here, but there are situations like that. So there's some, we've tested numerous case studies with these guys. We've done ones where the home is renovated and listed on the market. We've done them where they're renovated and not listed on the market. And I'll dive into these. And then we've done, we've tried a wholetale, which, you know, is basically a wholesale deal that you actually fund and take down and try to sell discount retail. Mm-hmm. And they've got trashed out and not renovated. And that's basically, and then recently we were able to do an ugly home that needed, 25 to, I actually had pegged it at 32,000 in repairs and they said 25 and we were able to do that deal with them and get it done, so that's a big one because they weren't buying ugly homes up until that one. So,
wow. Okay.
So to summarize the benefits, here's how it kind of plays out. You can get a home and here's the one learning though for everyone out there, you cannot wholesale to these guys. Now you don't have to have the thing necessarily bought, but you have to have a plan that you're definitely like shortly going to take ownership of it. Now with me saying that, if they heard that, they'd probably freak out, but
right.
Yeah, like for example, if I'm buying something on Wednesday, I could submit it Monday, and then they might if they make an offer, you know, they might say, hey, this is showing like Mary and John Smith own it, not you, not your business, and then I would send them over, like a redacted HUD or the deed, just copy saying, no, I just bought it, that's why I'm looking to sell it.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, and these guys don't really care, like. There's a couple benefits why I do that, but I do it because I want them to make an honest assessment of what they would pay me for the house that I just bought and not see what I just paid for it, like make them do the work. And here's the thing. That's where the magic is, right? Cause if you buy something for 160 and then you turn it into them like the next day, and they're going to get you an offer back in 24 to 48 hours. Like the recording time at our county is like, you know, it could be 3 to 5 days before it shows up so they can see what we paid for it. I was talking to somebody, I think might've been Ron Walraven out in Michigan. I can't remember, but he had said, I think it was like 2 months or 3 months before it shows up in his system.
Yeah, man, here in Miami, it takes easily 30 to 60 days. I've actually seen it sometimes take longer depending on the city in Miami. So, that's 3 to 5 days is nothing. That's lightning quick, but I could totally see why the timing of that is so important. I mean, if you take something down at a ridiculous price, and let's say, you know, they're looking at buying it for 160 or 170 because there's some juice in the deal. I could totally see why that can blow up your potential deal if they know what you've paid for it.
Yeah. So the benefit is they really are a wholetail buyer. Like they're like, they're going to be, so this one deal we did, we bought it for, this is the recent one that needed 32K in repairs. We did it for 158.8. We bought it for, and we tried to wholesale it at 190 and we got someone that was kind of serious. Not really. House was worth 250, 260. And, I just didn't want to, I'm like, I don't really want to do this rehab if I don't have to. And they came in at, after all said and was done, they were a 200K net offer and they'll do it in 8 days. So I'm like, I just gave two grand to my funding for, it's almost like flash cash, even though it was like 2 weeks and, netted that much more money and it was that much easier too. So they just fund it and go. So
that's awesome. So what types of homes are iBuyers looking for? I mean, are these just single family bread and butter type houses?
Yeah. They typically don't like any beater type homes and like class C or D areas. So, you know, they're not going to want your, like in our market, like your 30K to 55K built in 1910 homes that need a bunch of renovation. But they will buy, like they went and looked at a 1950 ranch that we renovated. And, it's really interesting because like on that one, they offered us $110,000 lower than what we sold it for 30 days later on the market. So yeah. They were completely off their mark there. And yeah, it's just, so it's interesting. Not all of them are going to work out. And the best ones to send to them are like houses that aren't going to need a lot of renovation for them to either resell or get them rented. Mm-hmm. So those are the best ones. And the worst ones you can give them are ones that you've renovated, put on the market. And if you've ever done a deal, which I know we all have, that just isn't selling, like for whatever reasons, once they see the high days on market, they're not going to offer you a very good offer for it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. Going back to the whole, like, you know, you don't want the buyer or an agent or an appraiser or whoever to see what you bought something for. One of the things that I know several people here in our market that have done is if you're working like direct to seller, is you can, let's say you agree on a price, $100,000, you can actually get the seller, you can make the purchase price, let's call it 120 or 130, if that's what you ultimately want to show the public as the purchase price, and then just get a repair credit on the HUD for that 20 or 30 grand. Does that make sense? That way, like when it gets recorded, people are now again, you got to make sure that that can be done in your market. But I know several people here in my market that do that all the time, you know? So that's one way to kind of.
Yeah. And then, you know what?
Yeah.
That's exactly what they do. That's exactly what they do. Like, I know Opendoor and OfferPad's fees are somewhere around 7.75%. They're like 7 to 8% commission, so to speak, but they call it their fee. Uh-huh. So what the way they're marketing, like people can learn from this too. When they're making offers, they'll like my 250K ARV home, their offer is 234.9, and then they automatically got that 15 grand off the price. And they, like, that's what they're doing to homeowners. So they're not even agreeing with that it's 250 ARV. They're coming in, they're like, no, our data is showing it's 234.9. So they've already gotten, what is that, 5% off the bat, 5 to 7%. And then they start like with their fee, and then they come back and hit you with repairs. So, you know, that number gets low really fast. So for us, we thought about test piloting working direct with sellers just in the same way. Like, hey, you know, everyone says Zillow, Zestimate, whatever. But all right, we'll give you your Zestimate, and then here's how we're going to take our fees, you know, to get to where we need to be. So that's something we've been test piloting too.
Okay. And Mike, this is something Zillow, that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man. But remind me, I want to follow up with a question there. But what were you going to say about Zillow?
Yeah, so Zillow... This is the way they work. They partner with a local brokerage in your city, and they, you know, everyone says, oh, Zestimate, that thing's never accurate. And it probably isn't in a lot of cases, but they always start with their Zestimate, and then they come down and work all their fees off. So they have like similar fees, and then their repairs, like on that house I was telling you where I came up with 32K in repairs, Opendoor came out at 26. I got them to reduce their repair estimate. You can negotiate with these guys too. That's if you're not desperate, that is one thing you can do. A lot of people didn't know that. Cause it's an offer, right? So go ahead and give them a counter offer. Zillow will not, they told me they don't negotiate at all. So Zillow came in with 40K on that same house in repairs. So they said, we need 10 days to do our due diligence, and we're never going to not pay what we quoted you. So they're not going to go in and do an inspection and then say we need more money off. So they actually just totally inflate the repairs right off the bat, subtracted off their estimate, then subtract their commission, which is 7 or 8% as well. Yeah.
Yeah, Mike. So that, I mean, dude, that's a perfect segue into like the process. So somebody listening that either, let's just say they just closed on a property, or they have a property under contract that they plan on double closing, or whatever the case might be, or there's just a property they have under contract that they haven't found a buyer for. What's the process? They go to offerpad.com or opendoor.com or, you know, Zillow, whatever the name is. I think you said Instant Offers. What's the process? They go online, they fill out a simple web form, and then like talk to me about the timeline and like what happens from there.
Yeah, that's all it is. So if you do that for Opendoor and OfferPad, you just go through a nice wizard, you put in the property address, you put in the all the, you upload all the pictures, all the standard data, like square footage, beds, baths, et cetera. And then they'll contact you with a email with an offer within 24 to 48 hours, depending on how busy they are. Mm-hmm. Offer Zillow, on the other hand, I think they're still a little behind the eight ball. So you go and do the similar thing. When we did it, we just couldn't even get our images uploaded to their site. There was all these challenges with file sizes. We're reducing the files. We eventually had to send Dropbox links over to all the files. Like, it was just really clunky process. And then they took like 12 days to get back to us. And that was with us following up. Then they had that crazy offer. So they had this super annoying overseas VA calling us like just to follow up. And then she scheduled a call with the local agent in our market, and he was cool, but he was the one that presented the offer with her on the phone.
Interesting.
So, yeah. And they present every offer in writing. So they'll present the offer to you. So for everyone, for your acquisitions process, they will email you the offer and then schedule a time to go over it with you like next day or two. So they, even if you think the offer is terrible, they'll still want to do that with you. And with Zillow, they still make that local agent that they're working with type it up in local realtor MLS form, you know, realtor specific forms for your state, and present it even if you've declined it.
Okay.
A lot of work going on.
Yeah. So it sounds like of the three, you said Zillow's, you know, kind of behind the eight ball. And I think you mentioned earlier on Opendoor has been the easiest one to work with in your experience.
OfferPad. Opendoor. Opendoor and OfferPad are very easy to work with. Opendoor's prices for what they'll pay is lower than, it's not as good as OfferPad.
Got it. Okay. And then, yep. So I'm assuming that when they reach out to you and they send you an offer, if you accept that offer, I'm assuming there's an inspection period. What kind of deposit are they putting down? Like, they're controlling more the terms of their offer?
They are. Like, they've got a local realtor brokerage firm. So like, they've got their own firm, like OfferPad and Opendoor have their own licensed brokerages in our state, where Zillow is partnering with another local small boutique firm to do it for them. So you'll get an actual normal realtor contract that says, like, I think it was $1,000, earnest money. It's held with their attorney in our local market. And, it's the normal process. They'll just say, hey, we're going to, some of them call it an inspection. Some of them call them like a property visit or whatnot to make it not sound so intensive, but they will go over with one of their own resources and do a quick inspection. And, in my opinion, I mean, OfferPad's been very fair. Like, you read all the nasty consumer ratings. But the reason, like, we, you and I know this, right? Like, and as independent, mom and pop shops, we can take all those bad BBB reviews and all the ones on Yelp or whatever, and we can show those to homeowners or sellers when we're working with them, to when they're like, oh, I might just have these guys make an offer and go with them. You can pull out all that stuff and have it in your backup file. Your acquisitions people can do that to show them, hey, that, you know, it's not so great.
Exactly. Wow.
Yeah. Then. So it's good. I mean, it's a normal process. So I would tell everyone out there, like, if they're in your market, just do it. Like, if you're not sure exactly what you're going to do with the property, I say it works best. If your exit is wholesaling only, you're not going to, this may not be good for you because you got to take possession of the property. You could send it to them though. Like, if you have flash funds lined up where you could buy it and hold the property for a week, and you want to see how much more spread you could make, you could test it that way. And that's to your point, Alex, there's nothing wrong with like it's free and it doesn't take long. It takes like 10 minutes to submit everything and you'll have an offer in 24 to 48 hours. So why not do it?
Yeah. So I'm glad you teed me up, because there's a lot of wholesalers that listen to this podcast, and, you know,
yeah,
sometimes we contract, matter of fact, so we have a property under contract right now. It's a wholetail type of margin. Therefore, like, we'd have to take it down, and it's questionable how much we could get. Like, so it's not really worth, in my opinion, taking that one down. But just for the, like, a mock scenario, let's say a property has an ARV of 200 and we contract property for, call it 160, 165. Right? Like, it's very difficult to wholesale that property if you're not offering some sort of, like, creative terms, or you haven't, like, done some creative financing. So that's not a property, like, at least in our market, that if I contracted it at 160, 165, it's worth 200. I wouldn't be closing on that property. You know what I mean? But would you recommend, if I have it under contract, would you let's just say I have a hard time finding a buyer, would you recommend sending it to these iBuyers and just, like, sending them a redacted contract if they ask for, like, would that fly, or would that just not work?
Yeah. So on the regulations side of it, like, or compliance with the docs, if they call you and say, hey, I didn't see this is even in your name as we're doing our due diligence, what's going on? In my opinion, they've never asked for proof. I just say, oh yeah, you know, I just bought it. And on Friday. And then if they ask for a copy of a deed or something, and I understand your scenario is you haven't bought it yet. But my point is, I don't think they're going to ask you for that copy of that contract. But if not, you could say, oh, you know what, we're actually running title on it now, and we're buying it next Tuesday, just to see. And then they'll probably just go away and do their evaluation. Because here's the flip side of what not everybody realizes. They have these ridiculous numbers of homes they need to buy every month. So they're trying to make it work however they can, right? They're not, that was a big learning for me. Cause I'm like, they don't really give a, you know what I did with it and what I got it for. They just want to get another one in their books. And so to answer your question on that, Alex, like, I would say if the house doesn't need a ton of repairs, with that spread being like 30 to 40K, like 160 to 200 or 170 to 200, if it doesn't need a lot of repairs, I would take the 7.75%, so call it maybe 10% off the 200 with their fees, and see if those numbers would work for you, you know?
Okay.
Because we did one with them where the requested repairs were only $1,100, and they'd rather just get a credit on the HUD, like when we sold it to them, than us do the repairs, but they'll let you do the repairs. So you might be able to squeeze out like 12 or 15K out of that. And that's something you never did before, you know?
I'm glad I brought up that scenario, because that's a deal that a lot of people are just probably going to throw away or try to go back and get a price reduction. Maybe it doesn't work. And there's an opportunity there to maybe make 10 to 15 grand, you know, once you factor out that 10%, that the iBuyer is going to knock you down. Now they're at 180. If you have it at 160, 165, like, you know, after closing costs, there's an opportunity to monetize that contract where it could be looking bleak, you know, that you're just able to wholesale it or find a buyer for it. So, very interesting, man. I think the one of the takeaways I'm hoping people get from this podcast as we start to kind of wrap it up is, go to offerpad.com, you know, Open Door, check out Zillow, see if they're in your market, and then go through the process. It's free. If anything, it could be a really interesting education for you as far as like how these big, big corporate structures are going through this process. Because, man, I don't know if you agree with me, Mike, but I don't get the sense this is going away anytime soon. If anything, I think it's just going to like be more prevalent across the US.
Yeah, I agree. You know, will they go into a market? We were talking to Nick, Nick up in Massachusetts. I'll leave his last name off of it. But like, will they go into like Boston or, you know, Providence, Rhode Island? Probably not, because the homes are so old and like need so much work. But who knows? But I'm a firm believer that brokerages, and I own a brokerage, but my brokerage is built to just support my investor. But like habits, that's what I tell everybody. I should make t-shirts and say that. But you know, basically, I think brokerages are going to be out of business. I think 80 to 90% of brokerages will be gone in like 3 to 5 years, probably 4 to 5 years. And I'm not saying that negatively. I'm just saying it's just like the travel industry. We've all talked about it, like with Priceline and all these. I mean, for a vanilla transaction, you know, yeah, why wouldn't it go away? And then I just heard too the other day, Alex, I don't know if you might've been in on this conversation, but all the big home builders are partnering with the iBuyers now. So Pete, it's going to be just like going to like the BMW dealership. They're going to look at your car and trade in your house like for your new house. So they'll just have like open door at the same meeting, just come over and cut the deal while you're pulling all the specs on your new home. You know, it's crazy. Yeah.
It's incredible, man. Technology is completely changing how business is done, and our market is starting to get affected by that. So figure out, you know, you're listening to this, figure out how you could take advantage of this and don't run away and kind of bury your head in the sand. So Mike, man, appreciate you, you know, diving in your market, man. Obviously there's several deals that you guys over there in Charlotte have sold to iBuyers and have benefited greatly from. So appreciate you kind of sharing your experience and some of these case studies with us. Hopefully people take this, and first step is really just to check if these iBuyers are operating in your market. And then if they are, just go through the process with one of the properties you have under contract or even a property that you own, and see how much more they're willing to pay versus you know, one of your cash buyers or a buyer in your market. So very cool, man. As we start to kind of wind down here, anything I haven't asked you about working with iBuyers, or did we pretty much cover everything?
Yeah, I think the last point of that might be helpful too to guys or gals that just want to be wholesalers, which is fine, or that's your number one strategy. You can also take these offers that you get, and if you can't do that deal because you can't raise the money to quick close it or whatever, show that to your wholesale buyer, right? Like, show them the offer. Say, hey, listen, right now they're offering in its current condition, you know, 190 or 195 on that. You know, you get at 160 or wholesaling at 170 or whatever. Right now they're offering this. If you do this, this, and this to it, value add, they'll probably be in the 210 to 215 range. And that's just kind of like an instant buyer. And you could probably do better on the local market, but just telling you, you know, so you can use it as a tool to get stuff off the shelf too.
Great tip. Love that. Very cool, my man. Well, hey, buddy, this is one of the last questions, or the last question I usually end these masterclass episodes with, but you're slightly older than I am. You exaggerated at the beginning of the show there. I'm guessing you're in your early 40s, early to mid 40s, max, if
yeah,
that, right?
Yeah, I'm 44. I actually, okay. I will tell all your listeners out there.
Well, dude, if it makes you feel better, you don't look a day over 43. How about that?
Dude, I appreciate that, man. You know, I wear that well. I'm going to get that on a t-shirt too.
I'm messing with you, man. So, dude, rewind the clock 15, 20 years. Knowing everything you know now, what's the one piece of advice you would share with yourself, the younger Mike Moulton? This could be... It doesn't even have to be business. It could be personal as well. Like, again, through the experience that you've accumulated the last 15, 20 years, what's the one thing you wish you knew when you were 24, 25 years old?
You know, it's funny you bring that up, and I would love to share this because this has extreme insight for anyone out there. So when I started, it was in that subject too. Range where I was acquiring a lot of properties. So right, that was 3 years before the market died. So that was a really tough time. Like, I got through it. A lot of people got through it. A lot of people didn't get through it. But I was acquiring any rentals that I was acquiring them because they were easy to acquire. Like, a seller said, oh yeah, I'll take, you know, $300 a month. It's paid off. But that house might've been an extreme hood where it's never going to appreciate, and you're going to be just paying for repairing that house forever, and they're just not good assets. So all of those types of experiences when the market took a hit made me not want to own as many rentals, because I kind of put them in a box that they're like a hassle. But I would tell my younger self and anyone out there, buy good assets young. When you're young, I mean, even buy them full retail in areas that are gonna, like, we were always taught never buy an appreciation. And I think that is such BS, because all my best stuff that I've held is in areas that's appreciated two or three times over 15 years. So I would tell people, even if you're buying like full retail MLS, but it's in an area where you're going to have like millennials renting it for the next 20 years, it's going to double or triple. Buy as much of that stuff as you can. Hold assets.
This show is sponsored by Ascend, our in-house assembly of success-minded people, business owners, and entrepreneurs actively collaborating together to ascend our businesses to new heights, while also experiencing truly happier, more fulfilling lives at the same time. We believe it's not an either or, but you can truly have both and. It's the unique and rare combination of mastermind coaching and community that makes Ascend so special, but it's definitely not for everyone. If you're an entrepreneur who's looking for more than your typical mastermind or coaching, and you think these things might help you accelerate your ascension from where you are today to where you want to go while living a more meaningful and rewarding life in the process, then you can find out more information at ascendyoursuccess.com. We'll schedule a call and go from there. Have an awesome day.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show, but we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.